Welcome to Simple Life Radio, stories for the adventurous at heart. I am your host, Cynthia Fernandez, and we are live streaming at RadioMonterey.com or through TuneIn. You can search for Radio Monterey and find us there. Archives from the shows are set up as podcasts, and you can certainly use those free of charge, either through going onto iTunes or to the Pilgrim's Way website at pilgrimsway.com. This show is dedicated to the human connection, people interested in simple life experiences and the unheard voices on the folks of the Central Coast of California. Someone asked me recently what my show is about, and I actually cover many topics with my guests. There's family, health, gardening and cooking, spirituality, art, photography. Really, my show is about life, simple life. It just so happens that simple life for some people is a, quote, alternative perspective. And in my perspective, it isn't a political subject. It isn't an economic one either. And yes, both of those are aspects of life, certainly part of the bigger picture. But let's be honest here. Politics are for the service of the people. You know, we the people. And economics are a means of exchange. So those two definitions are really important to remember to keep a healthy perspective. If that's liberal or progressive or alternative, well, then okay. But I'm really interested in people living the best, fullest, finest life possible. And we need each other to do that. We also need a safe and healthy place to live. Living here on the Central Coast of California is a beautiful thing, really rich in natural beauty with the coast lining the perimeter and the landscape that's very serene, and it draws visitors from all over the world. There are often environmental issues and have been for many years. You know, at one time, Monterey's economy was primarily whaling and fishing. And the now pristine marine sanctuary that we call Monterey Bay was a literal dump where canneries along Cannery Row would directly deposit the blood and guts of their catch. My guest last week shared the history of our Monterey Regional Waste Management and how that went right into the ocean originally. Years later, it went from the ocean to on the beach. If you heard that show, that was just that was an amazing piece of trivia to know from the history of where we live. And as the author of The Death and Life of Monterey Bay, Stephen Palumbi, describes in his book, things were very different, and we together decided that it was not a good idea to continue those practices. And now Monterey Bay is considered an example of what is possible the world over, turning a toxic dump in your marine situation back into a live, teeming, healthy sanctuary. In fact, I love the fact that the Monterey Bay Aquarium is built on the actual site of one of those toxic dumps that we used to call a fish cannery. Progress is an ongoing phenomenon. My guest today, Chris Landau, is a geologist and has agreed to speak about fracking, a subject that has many environmentally aware folks concerned. Ignorance is the biggest contributor to conflict, so I welcome you, Chris. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Cynthia. It's good to be here.
And it's good to have you. You know, I wanted to start, Chris, with the question or misunderstanding that most often people have about fracking.
Okay. I'll open up there on what fracking actually is. Fracking, as most people know, is the putting down in gas and oil wells of tons of water and chemicals to break up the rock. What fracking actually is fractional distillation and cracking. That's what the oil refineries do to extract oil and gas from longer chain hydrocarbons. Carbon chains of about 18 to 20 are then cracked, which means they're broken into shorter chains like methane or methane, a single carbon with the four hydrogens around it, or ethane, a double carbon, or propane, a triple carbon, and pentane, or trimethyl pentane, our gasoline and decane, a 10-chain carbon.
So when they're breaking up that shale, they're actually releasing that natural gas?
Yes, they're creating it. They're taking something like carbonaceous shale or coal, and they're adding hydrogen to that. Coal is a hydrogen poor compound. It's mostly carbon. And so what they're doing is they want flowability, they want gas, they want liquids. So what they do is they crack it and then they separate the different fractions. So it really is what they do in the refineries, fractional distillation, cracking of long chain carbons and separation of them.
And so people have a misconception about that?
Yes, they do. They see it as a physical process instead of a chemical process, which is done to a large extent in the Fischer-Tropsch reactions, which were invented in Germany in the 1920s and allowed Germany to continue in the World War because they didn't have any oil or gas. They only had coal, so they cracked the coal and they added hydrogen or hydrated the coal with water to create methane and gasoline and diesel compounds. So without water, there is no fracking. Water is the key. Water is the ingredient that has so much hydrogen in it, and they hydrate the coal. That's what cracking is.
And so, you know, here on the California western coast of the nation, we have a drought. We don't have a lot of water. Does this come into consideration when they're looking at the best opportunity to create energy for people's use?
It's actually quite an insane idea to take our fresh water and dump it down oil wells to increase the production of poorly producing oil and gas wells by hydrating carbon compounds down in these wells. So with a scarce resource like fresh water and a drought going on in California, it's actually an insane idea even to consider fracking, whether it's oil or gas wells or coal or carbonaceous shale beds. It's all a waste of our fresh water.
So I guess they do consider whether we have water to spare and then decide not to do it if we don't have water to spare.
I don't know what they consider. I think people actually get what they want via money and power.
Well, that's not a very good way to go about things. Now, why should we worry about this kind of practice going on? I mean, I know recently in the news, recently as in maybe a month ago, there was an article about how Monterey County, which I had no idea Monterey County was actually being considered to implement fracking. I mean, Monterey County, according to the economic reports, it's built on $4.14 billion of an agricultural business and $1.76 billion on tourism. So it doesn't strike me as where you'd want to start messing with the environment. I'm used to seeing wide open plains out in Nevada with oil wells and whatnot, but not in Monterey County. Anyway, the whole venture of fracking in Monterey County was postponed because they considered and analyzed the quality of shale and said that it wasn't basically worth it. Are you familiar with that decision?
I am from your side, Cynthia. I was not aware that they were going to frack or not frack the shale. I'm aware that they do fracking in oil and gas wells in California, as is. It's just adding water to carbon-poor compounds, whether it's a calcareous formation or a carbonaceous shale or a coal. It's all the same thing. What you're doing is you're adding hydrogen via water to carbon compounds to make less, more volatile compounds like gasoline and methane, ethane, propane, butane, all the mm-hmm. gases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that brings me to another question, Chris, and I don't know if this is a question really fair to direct to you, but if you and I didn't know that they were actually even thinking about fracking in Monterey County, then how do the public keep themselves aware of corporate endeavors and agendas in our own backyard?
I think that's where the reporters come in, to keep questioning, to keep finding out, and to keep keep an open mind, and who have friends, geologists, petrologists, guys in the oil and gas industry that are prepared to talk and tell them what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
The oil and gas industry is a really close-knit community, and they don't share their secrets, so it is generally hard for the public to find out.
Well, not to mention that these are billion-dollar corporations on an annual basis, and their profits are staggering. So there's a lot of power represented there, even though that is not the intention of the American government establishment. You know, power to the people and servants of the people and so forth. That's kind of where we live right now. So you're going to explain to us how fracking really works. I mean, very quickly, you've shared already how the shale is actually hydrated. That's why they need such immense amounts of water. Can you give us an example of how much water is used for something like, I don't know.
Well, what you need is 1 molecule of water with 1 molecule of carbon to make, you need 2 molecules of water and 1 molecule of carbon to make methane, which is the simplest form. So if you're going to take carbon in the form of coal or carbonaceous shale, you need a 1-to-1 ratio. And because you cannot, have all the carbon in a microcrystalline form and the water touching all compounds or points on that carbon, you're going to need more water. And so tons of water are needed for every molecule of carbon. You need 1 molecule of water. So if you're going to get millions of gallons of methane or cubic feet of methane or gasoline, you're going to need millions of gallons of water. And water is going to be used. It's going to be full of chemicals. It's then going to be dumped further down into the water table, which is also, for the most part, a freshwater table, even down to 10,000 feet. When I logged the oil and gas wells from 2005 to 2007 in the Central Valley and around the San Francisco Bay area, freshwater was found at, we did saline tests whenever we struck gas, and freshwater was often found at 10,000 feet. The amount of saline in that water was 300 parts per million, which is basically fresh. So we're ruining our water, whichever way you look at it. This fresh water, all the deep wells that have already been drilled in the California Valley could be turned into fresh water wells for farmers in this drought.
That's good news.
They exist. It is good news. They exist. So those abandoned oil and gas wells can now be turned into freshwater wells, as long as they don't keep dumping water and bad saline and chemical pollutants down below 2,000 feet.
Mm-hmm. And what is the depth typically of a well, let's say, for a farm?
In general, in the Central Valley, where I did most of my work, the gas was usually struck at about 5,000-6,000 feet, usually 7,000 feet, with multiple layers of gas down to 10,000-12,000 feet. They usually didn't continue deeper than that because of pressures, and the pressures would blow the mud or the drilling mud out of the well. So they tried to keep their wells to about 10,000 or 12,000 feet, and the deeper it got, the more pressure, the more they couldn't control the wells. A bit of a blowout would occur.
Well, there's a lot to this subject. We're going to take a short break here, but before we do, I want to let everybody know that we've got some things going on at the bookstore today, Pilgrim's Way Community Bookstore in Secret Garden. We had an author on site today, a local author who is just released a book about Carmel titled, Carmel by the Sea, The Early Years from 1903 to 1913. And she, her name is Alessandra Drumoff. She has done an incredible job of getting detail and description, lots of research done to put this book together. So I want to invite everybody, if you didn't make that event, you're welcome to come down and have a copy that we had her sign. You'll get your signed copy of that book, and you won't miss out. You know, there are a lot of events at Pilgrim's Way. You can look online if you do have a computer, pilgrimsway.com. Click on the events page and go right to the calendar that has all the detail there. If you want to give us a call, our number is 831-624-4955. We're happy to mail things. We do it routinely. We even offer curbside service. We'll run it out to you. You don't have to find parking. But we do need to take this break now, so stay with us for more with our guest today, Chris Landau, a geologist. We're speaking about fracking. When we come back, we're going to find out some creative ideas, things that we could do differently. So stay with us for more Simple Life. We're back in studio, Simple Life Radio here. I'm your host, Cynthia Fernandez, and our guest, if you're just joining us, Chris Landau, a geologist who is speaking to us today about fracking. Our goal is to really explain in a simple way what fracking is. Sometimes listening to any kind of marketing literature gets things more confusing, certainly can be misleading, and we want to inform folks so that we're all dealing with accurate information. So before I went to break, I had said when we come back, we're going to talk about some creative ideas and solutions to this problem. And then during the break, Chris said, well, there aren't really any. But when we were talking earlier, he said, you know, it's so crazy to use drinking water. It would make more sense to use saline rather than drinking water, especially in a drought, right, Chris?
It would make more sense, but then you will be polluting your fresh water with saline water.
Not a good idea. Okay, and I understand that the function of drilling down so deeply in the deep underworlds causes earthquakes, or is questioned as to whether it causes earthquakes.
Yes, earthquakes are definitely caused by lubricating fracture zones. Water is a lubricant, and when you add water to fault zones which already exist, it makes the fault slip much more easily. At the moment, drilling takes place between about they get gas from about 1 mile down to 6 miles. Most wells are probably in the region from 2 to 4 miles down. And if we look at Oklahoma today, there's been a massive increase in earthquakes there. In fact, if you have a look at the last week, you'll see over 7 days the earthquakes up to magnitude 4 in Oklahoma are higher than those in California. And the USGS and EPA have taken notice of this. And they're looking at why the earthquakes have increased so dramatically. And because they're shallow earthquakes at around 3 miles in depth, I would put them down to drilling oil and gas wells in Oklahoma. They're not deeper, like 10 miles or beyond the reach of human drilling rigs.
Well, we've been drilling gas in Oklahoma for a really long time, I think. I mean, relatively a really long time, right? At least 50 years.
That's correct, but fracking people don't just see as, I think people see it generally as related to carbonaceous shale or coal, but fracking has been taking place in oil wells as well, and the oil industry knows that if you add water, you hydrate carbon, and if you've got thick oil down there that won't flow, you dump water down under pressure and you hydrate that oil and you make it a thinner oil. All coal is desiccated oil, it's dried up oil, and by using fracking and water, you're just hydrating the coal and making it more volatile, either in a gaseous or a liquid form. So that's what fracking is all about. Don't just see it as fracking for coal and carbonaceous shale and calcareous sandstone. Fracking is in oil and gas wells, and that's what it's all about. Put down water under great pressure to increase the production of declining oil and gas wells.
So let me see if I get this properly. So they drill a well down between, you said, 1 and 6 miles. And yes, they use a combination of fresh water and some specific chemicals that are shot down that well and then mix, basically blast it out under there, right?
Well, they put it under pressure. And so what you're doing is, it's called the saboteur reaction and the Wirth synthesis, as well as the Fischer-Tropsch synthesis. The saboteur reaction is actually what you do is when you create carbon dioxide and hydrogen. You get the hydrogen, first of all, from the water gas shift reaction, which was originally done in our town gas or made gas many years ago. What we did there was we took water and carbon and we mixed those together to get carbon, and we heated them in the absence of air to get carbon monoxide. So we mm-hmm. burnt it poorly. Then with carbon monoxide, which is just CO, we added water to that and we got hydrogen gas. Once we got and carbon dioxide. Once we got the carbon dioxide, we added more hydrogen to that and we got methane, and that's called the saboteur reaction. Then when with the Fischer-Tropsch reaction, we take carbon monoxide and hydrogen gas, and we take an abundant amount of both quantities, and we do it many steps until we get long chain hydrocarbons like methane, ethane,
now,
propane, butane.
Having not taken as much science as you, Chris, I'd sort of over my head, but I think I get the basis of it. And at some point, the pressure moves that product back up. Whatever the mixture is, whether it's methane, butane, etc., it will pressure it back up. And then they can collect it.
That's correct. What you're doing is you're taking a hard source like carbon or coal and you're hydrating it with hydrogen from water and you're turning it into a gas or a liquid like diesel, gasoline, or methane, ethane. So you're basically converting a solid by so-called fracking, which is really hydration of long chain coal, carbons into shorter chain gases and liquids.
And then what's left after that has been removed is the mixture of water and chemicals that they used?
Water and chemicals is left, and also the very thick fractions of carbon molecules in greases, waxes, that are beyond carbon 20. So between carbon 20 and carbon 60, those, some of them will not be hydrated, and some will be bound to silica, so it'll be difficult, which is sand. It will be difficult to get the you get the gas out of that. So you're leaving longer chain molecules behind, you're leaving the chemicals behind, and you're adding and you're making your water oily and gaseous, and that water makes its way up through the fractures because it's volatile, and it makes its way to the surface. So it bubbles up with the fresh water, drives
the water. How long does that process take for it to leave the 1 to 6 miles below the surface, be all basically rototilled up with the shale, et cetera, that's there, and then it makes its way back to the surface? How long of a time frame?
I would say that would take place in a year or two, depending on how cracked the formations are. If the formations are very fractured, like they are in California, it could make its way up within a year. If they're not so cracked, it might take longer to make its way up. But you basically pressure fracturing your wells as well and the surrounding area, and you're drilling wells sometimes as little as 500 feet apart and closer sometimes. So the more you fracture and break up the formations, the more your water is going to be polluted and the more gas is going to come up to your drinking water table and be found in your drinking water.
Well, as you're describing this, you know, sinking a well and blasting down some high-pressured water, etc., churning it up down there and then drawing out whatever can be drawn out for manufacturing gas, I'm thinking about the instability that introduces to that particular landscape.
It does. In fact, that's what happened actually down in Los Angeles when they removed the oil and gas wells in those areas. They had subsidence there and the ground level would drop as much as, I think it was 40 feet. And so there were many earthquakes in that time. And that's the big danger of lubricating fracture zones with water, that you're going to take what might be a small slippage area and turn it into a massive earthquake. And I think that's what's happening in Oklahoma. They're actually just massively injecting water into an area that was not normally known for earthquakes, and now earthquakes are occurring up to magnitude 4 and a little higher. So hydration and removal of that coal, carbonaceous shale, calcareous sandstone will cause the landscape to subside, and you'll get sinkholes forming as well. There's nothing really good about any of it, sorry to say.
Yeah, that is bad news. So the earthquakes in Oklahoma, I mean, California is known for earthquakes, and generally Oklahoma is not known for earthquakes. Are they sizable earthquakes? How frequent are they? Is this sort of an indicator for other areas in the nation that are fracking zones?
Yeah, if you go to the USGS map of earthquakes and you just look on there, they have the earthquakes that occur around the world over the last, you can look at maps over the last day, over the last week, over the last month, over the last year, and you can just look at where they're occurring, and daily they updated hourly, so you can see where earthquakes are occurring. And so about 2 years ago when I looked, there was just about no earthquakes in Oklahoma. And I keep an eye open for earthquakes all the time. So on the USGS maps, now they're abundant and they're occurring daily, and they're right in Tornado Alley.
Oh no, that's a bad combo.
It is a bad combo.
Oh my gosh. So do they at least set these things up hundreds of miles away from any civilization?
What do they set up, Cynthia? They don't set these things up far away from civilizations, as you know. They put them right in our backyard. They just don't talk to us about them. They're occurring all around you all the time. They're sometimes a few miles away. I've worked on places in the San Francisco Bay Area that were a couple of miles from houses, really not far at all. I've worked on many gas and oil wells that are a couple of miles from any place, and they're right on top of the farmhouses.
Now, as you can tell, Chris is pretty well versed in this, and he's both a meteorologist and a geologist, so he's got a lot of science behind him that helps him go through this very quickly, certainly more quickly than I can. But I do, Chris, admire the work that you've put into your website, the Open Ed News. Would you be willing to share that website with people?
I would do, and it's a great website for information. I have some published papers there, published by the American Institute of Professional Geologists, peer-reviewed papers on how oil, gas, and coal are formed and what fracking is all about. And I'll be glad if Cynthia does publish that and answer any questions that people might be interested in asking.
Yeah, it's intensely rich in research. You can tell that people are paying attention, and I'm so grateful that we have free speech in America. We can share that information directly with each other, certainly through our news media and entertainment. Now, I've been thinking as you've been talking about this, Chris. All right, we have the Environmental Protection Agency. That is a federal agency, if I'm not mistaken, that is dedicated to protecting the environment. What's the way in for fracking?
I think the way in for the EPA or the USGS to take real notice is for people to scream and shout out loud that they won't take it anymore, because I don't know what it takes. Does it take an earthquake magnitude 5 or 6 or 7 in a place like Oklahoma for them to take notice and eventually say stop, enough of the fracking, enough of water injection into the wells to make them slip faster?
Well, I'm looking at the EPA website, epa.gov, and it says their mission is to protect human health and the environment. So it seems completely appropriate to let them know, if they're not already aware, that this contamination of fresh water, and certainly the heavy use of fresh water in cases where it's displacing human usage of fresh water entirely. I know there's a town back in Virginia that had that happen last year. It would be appropriate to let them know about that because it is their mission to protect human health and the environment. But isn't it true, Chris, that the same regulations enforced by the EPA for refineries above ground are not the same for below ground?
Yeah, below ground is out of sight, is out of mind, and less evidence to the contrary comes to light in the sense of gas in people's drinking water or earthquakes occurring and the depth of the earthquakes. And the USGS website is a great site for that because it tells you exactly what depth the earthquake occurred. So if it's 3 or 4 miles down, 2 miles down, 1 mile down, and there's oil and gas drilling taking place, that's the cause most likely. In California, along fault zones, it can be multiple causes. But in a place like Oklahoma, it's probably the oil and gas fracking industry. And the EPA should be taking quicker notice, and the USGS should be acting faster, but these things grind on, and the USGS and the EPA have shut down drilling in the past, and fracking and injection of water into wells because of the increased faulting and movement of the earth and earthquakes occurring.
In those situations that you're referring to, was that an action of moratorium, or how did that come about? Where did that happen?
I know that happened in places like Virginia. I know that it's happened in Colorado. So it's happened in many places around the country in the past. I think if one just Googled that, one would find out where the EPA has shut down injection of water into wells, mm-hmm. which is called slippage.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to know about that. You know, it's difficult these days to not become a real skeptic, to not give in to conspiracy theory tendencies, because, you know, if a guy like you, no disrespect, if you understand all of this so clearly and these websites are available on a daily basis, updated hourly about earthquakes, research is available online easily about fracking, etc., then it causes one to question why the governmental agencies are so slow to take action and to take real action. And so we're going to need to take another break here. But when we come back, what I want to talk about is more on really, what do we do? The people, the everyday life that we're living, what can we do in our situation? There's, a tendency, again, to think that you're powerless and there's nothing that you can do and all the corporations are evil. And that, of course, is not a powerful position to find yourself in. So we're going to take that break. And when we come back, we'll talk more with Chris Landau, our guest, a geologist, speaking about fracking. And I'm your host, Cynthia Fernandez. Stay with us for more Simple Life. And we're back in studio with our guest today, Chris Landau, a geologist, speaking to us about fracking. And we have gone through many aspects of what fracking is, technically, scientifically, and in layman's terms. We've identified that it is a very extreme use of drinking water, which we are finding ourselves short on. I should mention our weather changing, our patterns of weather change, that is adding to the lessened amount of drinking water, fresh water available to us. And and we identified that it's difficult to actually know what these multi-billion dollar corporations are doing in our backyard. We rely heavily on journalists of all sorts to inform the public about that. The drilling not only has an impact on freshwater wells, but also on crops above ground, livestock above ground, certainly people above ground. And the EPA has a different set of rules for anything happening below ground. So all of those things have been covered already. We're now at the element of what can the individual person do? Where is our power? It's easy to feel overwhelmed and powerless and find yourself getting really dark and negative. So we want to look at what can people do. And so, Chris, you said we could write to the EPA and report our concerns to them.
Correct, Cynthia. That would help. And also to your congressman, to your local town council, to the farmers eventually when they realize that it's not all about getting oil and gas money from underneath their farms. One day their farms won't have any fresh water. So if we stop the injection of water down into these wells, our fresh water, our precious water, fracking stops. Fracking would not be possible by explosives, for example. They say, oh, well, it's cracking open the formations and releasing the oil. Try blasting the oil wells or the gas wells and see what you'll get. You'll get nothing, because fracking is not just cracking. It's hydration. It's using the hydrogen in H2O to add to carbon in water. That's what fracking is. It's cracking and hydration of carbon or coal.
Which we, in our discussion here, Chris, found out that there are no positive solutions for. I mean, there's no antidote for fracking. There's just the contamination for however long. We honestly don't know how long the contamination would go before we turn it around. So on an individual lesson, how about the impacts to CO2 emissions? I mean, I plant a garden. I know you plant a garden. Isn't that something that an individual can do?
Yes, I would say that if you can limit your water use, limit your air conditioning use, then you'll be saving water for the future. But the amount of water that we in towns use compared to the fracking industry, the oil and gas industry, it's minute. They're using vast quantities of water to pump down these wells and pressurize these wells and then polluting the water. And as with a refinery, or not with a refinery, where the water has to be cleaned up, they can't just dump it somewhere underground. The dirty water is just dumped below a certain level that's classified as saline, and that's not going to help. It's going to make its way up through volatility to the surface, through gas, through oil, which is lighter than water, and float through the cracks and come up to the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then it just wreaks havoc on whatever is at the surface. And since we're back on that topic, Chris, how long is there any study? I know you do a lot of research on this. Is there any study as to how long the healing process takes before an environment will return to its state prior to fracking usage?
I would say as soon as you start removing the water, the injection of massive amounts of water, the healing would stop. It would be almost instantaneous. It would there'd still be a year or two's volatiles from the carbon making their way to the surface, but without that continuous injection and under pressure, no cracking and no hydration of carbon takes place. So it basically stops as soon as the water injection into the wells stops. That stops. So it's a good thing. It's almost immediate.
Well, and I know some of the uses of electricity, which of course is driving this incredible business to find more innovative and abundant ways to create electricity, gasoline, etc., is driven by consumers. So let's not discount the value of your buying choices. Shopping locally, of course, is going to save on CO2 emissions. Buying things that are not in plastic, doesn't that also reduce CO2 emissions because of the heavy impact prior to the container being put out for sale, and then also what to do with it afterward?
Yes, it does help. And anything that you can do to use renewable resources like solar, wind, wave, hydroelectricity from dams, although that's going to be a tough one when there isn't any water in our dams in the drought areas of California and southern United States. So, yeah, if you can use renewable resources to the greatest degree and reduce your air conditioning use, you reduce electricity consumption, then you also stand a good chance of helping save our water and the pollution from that.
You know, the staggering aspect of this is that it's not a short-term fix that we're looking for. We're not looking to just make it to the finish line, meaning, you know, let's save Monterey in 2015. This is an ongoing lifestyle issue, really. It's a perspective that we all have adapted that is just sort of coming to bear. So it's going to take a lifestyle change to get something a little different in the mix to get us back to balance and find a place of harmony, and health, really. So anytime you can support local, buy local, go to the farmer's market, think about whatever it is that you're purchasing and how long it took to get there. There's a lot of information available now about corporations and the power of the public in terms of boycotting corporations, hurting them in the monetary area is very well listened to. And I mean, history repeats itself over and over in that regard. So if you find out about corporations carrying on a practice that is outside of your value system or what you really don't want to endorse, then you have a choice not to purchase their product. And I think that that is a power that we can easily forget. So, Chris, is there something else that we haven't covered today? Because I see the clock is ticking away and I don't want to run out of time.
Some positive things that came about from my logging of oil and gas wells that I found out was that as the Russians had found for the last 50 years, 60 years, that oil, gas, and coal are inorganic. They're not from fossils. They're not from plankton. They're not from dead trees. The whole fallacy has come about by the old thing of size matters. If you bury a saber-toothed tiger or a mammoth in an oil or a tar pit like the La Brea tar pits near Los Angeles, and we dig them out 10,000 years later, we say, well, they're fossils buried in oil. If we bury a fish in sandstone or sand, and it later turns up as a sandstone, we say it's a fish buried in sand. And if we bury a shell in limestone, and we see it later as a calcareous sediment preserved in limestone, we say it's a shell preserved in limestone. But when we get very small to the size of plankton and we bury those in a oily compound, we say, ah, the plankton created the oil. So it's a silly idea, and it never happened. Oil, gas, and coal are inorganic. They being produced all the time from deep within the earth, especially from methane and hydrogen deep within the earth. So it's not something that's going to be running out soon. We've always been told that this oil, gas, and coal is limited. It's being produced all the time. Coal is just desiccated oil. It's dried out oil. So it's interesting in that sense that it's all inorganic. Oil, coal, gas, they're all made from natural compounds. It's just a drying out of carbon compounds. On the surface we have calcium carbonate, which if we hydrate goes to carbon dioxide. If we hydrate it more, goes to carbon monoxide. If we hydrate it more, goes to carbon. We hydrate it more, it goes to coal, which is about a C4H1, and then we go to C2H2, which is diesel, gasoline, and then finally CH4, which is methane. So it's all a hydration product. On the surface of the earth we have an oxygen-rich environment, down below we have a hydrogen-rich environment, and that's what it's all about. So we have to stop the use of water for hydrating this carbon and turning it into gas and oil. And if we can do that, and we save our fresh water for our future and for our children's future as well.
Very, very worthy cause, definitely worthy cause. Sometimes I think we just need to lift up our head out of the the sand in order to see things clearly. And it's difficult, as I say, because it can be overwhelming. There's a lot of grief certainly involved from the feeling that we were tricked or that we were taken advantage of. Sometimes that is a tendency to feel. It may or may not be the case, but certainly understandable. So, Chris, we so appreciate you being willing to come and share your wealth of knowledge with our Simple Life listeners so that ignorance is not an issue for us. And together, as I say, we can certainly come up with creative ways to adjust our lifestyle, not only to save our future, but also to be happier, to be healthier, and to live more fully in the time that we have here on the planet. So I definitely want to appreciate and thank you for taking the time to drive down. And if people want to get a hold of you for any reason, I know that you do have a business where you sell fruit trees and barrels.
That's correct.
How do they get a hold of you, Chris?
They can get hold of me through my two websites of buybarrelsanddrums.com and also through treeswithfruit.com. I also have a website for scientific papers at Op-Ed News. If you just Google Chris Lando, Op-Ed News, you'll find a wealth of technical information there and published papers and presentations that I wrote there for over a couple of years.
And that website is opednews.com, right?
Yeah, that's it. And just put in Chris Lando, and it'll be Chrislandau, and that'll get you to published papers and information.
That's awesome. Well, thanks again. I have a couple of things to cover here, but so appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Cynthia, for having me. I've enjoyed being here.
I'm so glad. So we have an event in the store next Saturday, a local author, Harvey Kraft. You may know him. His book is titled The Buddha from Babylon, The Lost History and Cosmic Vision of Siddhartha. And there is a endorsement by Mariel Hemingway, The Buddha from Babylon could be the answer to many questions. This is a fascinating and hugely informative read. He will be at Pilgrim's Way on Saturday from 1 to 3 in the afternoon, right in the front of the store. We do have his books in the store now. If you're interested, next time you're in, take a look. If you're wanting to access it remotely, you could always give us a call and we'd send it to you. Our number again, 831-624-4955. We mail all over. The following day is the first Sunday of July, and the first Sunday of every month, we have a tracking club that meets, Monterey Bay Tracking Club. They do have a Facebook page with lots of information, a map, and certainly lots of photos. We meet at 8 o'clock in Marina. We meet at the Ord Market on Imjin. It is a free event. Paul and I will be there. We're actually leading the group this month. Hopefully we will have a great group with us. So I hope that you will join us. Certainly, it will be a time you will not forget. So appreciate you being part of our show today. Tuning in, tell a friend, Radio Monterey is still here. We have great programs being added all the time. I think you'll be surprised. I'm happy to be with you, and I will be with you again next Saturday. Until then, keep it simple.